Welcome, everyone, to our first afternoon session devoted to shop talk, nurturing honest dialogue across labor divides. I wanted to thank Susan, Tamsin, and Christine and everyone else involved in organizing this unprecedented and deeply engaging event. I'm going to save my short comments for after the panelists, but just introduce them by saying that this panel will bring to another, and I think in many ways more local and fine-grained level, much of what was begun in the earlier conversation of the previous panel, as well as continue that conversation. We'll be starting with Charles Chang, Assistant Professor of Linguistics. Next, we'll have Nancy Gerntis, Executive Assistant to the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Daniel Kleinman, Associate Provost for Graduate Affairs and Professor of Sociology. Jessica Lambert, a doctoral student in cultural anthropology. And Marisa Milanese, who's a member of the writing program faculty. So I'll pass things to Charles. Thank you.
Oh, great. Thanks so much for organizing this event. So what can I say about the topic of this panel, nurturing honest dialogue across labor divides? In my remarks, I'll focus on the student-teacher divide, but I think the main point applies as well to other divides, those between faculty of different ranks or different levels of seniority, between faculty and administrators, between faculty and other staff, and so on. What these divides have in common is a difference in status and or power between parties, which introduces a major obstacle to honest dialogue. And, you know, one might ask, why does this power imbalance matter so much? Let me illustrate with an example from my classes. So recently I was teaching and I misspoke when describing the features of a particular language, Ewe, which is a national language of Ghana. And I inadvertently conflated this language with another language whose name is also spelled with three letters, describing the features of that language instead. Anyway, the point is that I made an honest mistake. No one corrected me, and it didn't occur to me until days later when I was preparing for the next class and recalling what happened in the previous class that I realized my error. All's well that ends well. I eventually clarified the language landscape appropriately. But, you know, it would have been preferable if the error had just been corrected on the spot. Now you may be thinking that perhaps no one corrected me because no one knew enough to recognize that I had misspoke. But no, there was actually at least one student who knew enough about the languages of Ghana that for that person to know that what I was saying was not correct. So why no correction of such a seemingly little mistake? Well, despite my best efforts to create a safe and friendly classroom environment, it doesn't and it really cannot change the fact that my role there is the teacher. I'm supposed to be the figure who knows stuff, and I'm in front of others who ostensibly know less about the topic at hand. And on top of this, I'm also the one in this relationship who holds the more consequential evaluative role over the other. So ultimately, in my view, students cannot know whether pointing out my mistake, which is inherently a face-threatening act, and by that I mean that it has the potential to embarrass or undermine another, they can't know whether that will be perceived by me in a reasonable way. So, despite my explicitly saying it's totally okay and in fact encouraged for people to correct me when I make an error, talk is cheap. You know, will I instead feel embarrassed or undermined if a student dares to correct me? Who can really know based just on what I tell them? You really need to be in my head to know for sure. So in this case, students weren't willing to risk it and, you know, stayed silent. Honest dialogue did not happen. Now, if that were the end of the story, that would be pretty sad. Thankfully, it's not the end. So I took this moment from my classes as a teachable moment and implemented the following policy. So now when a student corrects an error I've made, and preferably on the spot, they earn themselves an extra credit point on the next homework. So suffice it to say, students love this policy. I I actually, due to recurring, a war with Blackboard, I now implement all class communication via a messaging app called Slack, and multiple students, they gave thumbs up reactions on Slack to the announcement of this extra credit policy. So why do I think this policy has helped? I think it's because it's a concrete signal that I value honesty, which lowers the perceived risk of communicating honestly in the face of a power differential. Now, under this new policy, students, they don't have to guesstimate the odds that I will react poorly to being corrected and, for example, give them a low participation grade or, whatever it is. They know for certain that their honesty is perceived positively. So to put it another way, I've raised the stakes for honesty from something that is merely encouraged to something that is actually rewarded. So in the end, I think that's a crucial thing for honest dialogue across labor divides. To foster honest dialogue means for the more powerful to demonstrate clearly, which means more than words, that they value honesty, even or especially when it's face-threatening. Without this demonstration, ultimately, I think the less powerful will always be left rolling the dice as to whether honesty is really worth the potential negative consequences. Thanks.
I'm honored to have been asked to participate in this forum today, and I'd like to thank Susan Mizrahi and her team for organizing this and for allowing me to participate. As a staff member of the College of Arts and Sciences here at BU, my role in this forum is to provide insight about what it's like to be in my position in the office of the CAS Dean. Staff are rarely asked to participate in this type of open forum, so I consider it a privilege and, quite frankly, a step in the right direction in opening doors for everyone and making a variety of voices heard. Staff are critical to the functioning of the university, and they harbor valuable information about its different processes. I would go so far as to say that the staff are the nuts and bolts of holding organizations together. Staff will either make or break an institution, and their thoughts and opinions should matter. They may not have the title of president, nor the multiple degrees of administrators or faculty, but they are the worker bees guarding the stories and secrets, institutional historians, I might add, with knowledge and experience that could prove helpful, even indispensable, to the running of our departments, programs, and services. My position as the executive assistant to the dean of CAS is a large one and critical to the running of the dean's office. I'm responsible for the dean's calendar, their travel plans, planning, managing, and expediting their events, both at the dean's residence and elsewhere, keeping the front office running smoothly and efficiently along, and keeping the dean informed of anything that he or she needs to be informed about. I assist with the development alumni relations work that the dean is increasingly engaged in. I'm the person who schedules appointments and determines what meetings need to happen immediately and what meetings the dean can miss or what we can delay. Decisions of this kind require intimate knowledge of the university and its various initiatives and personnel. I have heard it said that I'm considered the unseen power behind the throne of the dean's world. Despite this apparent power and significance, staff are rarely recognized and even more rarely heard. In fact, it is rare for the views and opinions of staff to be solicited at all. For example, in the recent search for a new dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, I was not asked to participate. As committees were being formed and schedules established, there was no mention of any potential role for me. And it occurred to me how strange this was. After all, I had been the executive assistant to two previous deans, witness to what worked and what didn't work for them during their tenure as dean. Who knows better than I thought, about what a dean's life is like or about the types of traits a dean needs, having worked 40 hours a week, year after year, with our next dean's predecessors. For instance, what kind of temperament should a dean have? What management style works best for the college as a whole? So I approached the provost and the dean's search committee and asked if I could please be included in the interviews of the finalists. And I'm very grateful to say that I was subsequently included in these important meetings. I was happy to have been able to participate in a decision that perhaps impacts my day-to-day life more than that of anyone in the college. I think that in order to nurture honest dialogue across labor divides, we need to find more ways to enable members of the university to be heard in decisions that affect them directly and to which they can contribute invaluably. And not by anonymous surveys, but by bringing people to the table and listening to what they have to say. Thank you.
So my labor divide is between faculty and academic administrators. Historically, the core of major research universities has been overseen by scholars, people who prior to entering academic administration were typically faculty members themselves. Why then is the divide between faculty and university leadership often so large and the distrust of administrators by faculty so common? Let me posit an essentially social structural explanation, an analysis that will inevitably oversimplify given the constraints of time. So most faculty are trained in disciplines. At R1 universities, their most fundamental commitments are to their fields. The recognition they receive happens in their fields based on their scholarship. I would go further, speaking from my extended career as a faculty member, and say that we are typically not socialized or trained to think of universities as integrated wholes, intellectual ecologies. Beyond the perspective shaped by disciplinary commitment, my own experience is that members of the professoriate are rightly constitutionally skeptical, especially dubious of authority, including that of academic administrators. Now, before I go much further, I want to note that university faculty and BU faculty in particular are stratified in complex and contradictory ways. This makes dialogue even within the faculty fraught. Today, however, the gulf I want to discuss is centrally between tenure stream and/or full-time governance faculty and university leadership. My move into administration was gradual, and while I can't speak for all administrators, I can give you my sense of what it means to me to have an administrator's perspective, and how and why that perspective does little to lessen the gulf between faculty and administrators. As a department chair at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, my job was to get more resources for faculty hires, graduate students, symposia, faculty and graduate student travel, and to prevent resources from being taken away. It was when I served as the director of an interdisciplinary center that I began to see beyond my individual unit. I was still responsible to protect my center and expand its footprint and resources, but making the center work depended, unlike the case for my department, on drawing faculty and students from across the university, on constructing broad networks of reciprocity, and on building collaborations with departments and other centers university-wide. I started to think of myself more as a university citizen, a scholar, and an intellectual more than as a sociologist and departmentally based professor. It was when I moved into so-called central administration that I really saw my perspective diverging from my faculty colleagues. Most essentially, I needed to think in terms of the overall good of the university, not only in terms of what my single department wanted. A university is made up of a wide and diverse array of entities, colleges, departments, centers, and so forth, and the resources that go to one entity are not available for another. And the reasons for allocating resources vary from the broad, visionary, and strategic to the highly contingent. Funds may be needed in one area to boost faculty morale, in another to allow the university to compete in a dynamic research field. In other areas, university leaders might conclude that further investment in these units isn't warranted given all of the university's other needs. On the matter of faculty skepticism and the gulf between faculty and academic leaders, leaders often are not in a position to be 100% transparent about their decisions. These decisions might be shaped, as at the University of Wisconsin, by the need to placate the legislature, or by complicated financial pressures, or by very contingent situations involving faculty retention. That said, certainly sometimes administrators fail to provide as clear and detailed explanations as they might. I think to have a vibrant intellectual community means seeing the university as a whole, seeing the pieces, the departments in relationship to one another. I would argue that many faculty would benefit from having some of this perspective, and universities would benefit too. At the same time, if administrators lose the dispositions that shaped their reactions as faculty members, they will fail to anticipate faculty pushback in relation to particular administrative decisions, and will be unable to navigate and effectively respond to faculty distress and resistance. We shouldn't forget Bourdieu's representation of the academic field. As a field like any other, with its divergent interests, power asymmetries, and resource distributions. Inevitably, faculty and administrators look at their shared world differently. Still, I think we would all benefit from institutionalized and informal efforts to encourage all of us to see our shared world from the vantage point of the other. Thank you.
First and foremost, I'm so thankful for what other panelists have shared here today and to all of the organizers for their hard work. As an anthropologist, I value the power of a personal story that illustrates a broader theoretical point. As a feminist and a Marxist, I recognize the importance of analyzing who tells that story, how it's being told, how it came to be. But today, I'm not going to tell you about having or postponing starting a family while in graduate school. I'm not going to tell you about taking medical leave or filing for disability accommodations. I'm not going to tell you about another failed Title IX complaint. I'm not going to tell you about trauma and fieldwork. I won't tell you about the whisper networks that try to protect graduate students from abusive faculty members. I'm not going to tell you about overwork and underpay and the rising costs of living in Boston. Because the truth is, you've heard these stories before. You've read them in the Chronicle, you've talked to your students, and many of you had your own experiences in graduate school. Telling you my stories here today would not just be a public and unnecessary exposure, but it would obscure the very real working conditions of graduate students. My working conditions. If I told you what it looks like to be a graduate student here at BU, I wouldn't be telling a close friend or even a room of strangers. I'd be sharing my thoughts about my work and my working conditions with professors in my department, with the deans who oversee the graduate division, with their bosses, with all of their colleagues. As graduate students, we have many bosses. It may not always be clear who reports to whom, especially as the university becomes increasingly bureaucratized, but we all have professors who supervise our lab work, our teaching, and our research, even more who sign off on our exams and degree progress. A web of professors and administrators decide who receives office space, summer funding, time off from teaching. Decisions are communicated up to deans and to provosts, to the president and back down. These are our bosses and we are the workers. And to speak with a semblance of honesty about the work that graduate students do to a room full of bosses, the people who make decisions about our working conditions, requires a guarantee that we will not experience retaliation. you might think, retaliation from these people. But the fear that prevents me from speaking to the particulars, the names, the details, the specific incidents, is not the same as a refusal to apply the knowledge that we all have about the structures of power and academia to your coworkers or to your bosses, and to understand their decisions and their actions to be in line with the interests of the university, with the university's strategic initiatives, its profit, its brand, its mission. So when we are asked to tell these stories, this is why we do it together, or why we do it anonymously. Because when people without power act alone, it is exceptionally easy for the university, for its structures, for its bureaucracy, to swallow us whole, to silence us, to force us out. And this is why the stakes are high. Without protections, without a guarantee, we cannot discuss the conditions of my labor here at BU. It makes me too vulnerable. And I'm not alone. The stakes are the same for all of us. Even when students aren't sharing these stories with you, they're still experiencing this. As graduate students and workers, we do not have a contract. We have no guarantees. I am not guaranteed workplace protections or anonymity under Title IX. HR and the ombuds serve my employer, not me. My pay is not tied to my performance, my workload, or my experience, and I have no opportunity to negotiate for a raise. Although the university seems to be ambivalent about whether or not I do work, I'm not confused. I am a worker. I am also a student. But without even the basic recognition that I'm a worker, I find it hard to believe that we can overcome the antagonistic struggle between boss and employee through dialogue, when we cannot even acknowledge that I am in fact employed by Boston University to teach anthropology, and that I am sometimes also paid for my research and studies. So if we really want to talk about the labor that we do as graduate students and workers, we have to first acknowledge and recognize the vast power disparities that exist in academia, because there are real consequences to talking about them. And the only way we've successfully changed any of the structures that exacerbate these divides has been by building power and solidarity, and by forcing our bosses to recognize the work that we do, the power we hold, and to sit down at a bargaining table with us.
Thank you for having me here, and thanks for allowing me to be on this panel. It's an honor to be with all of you. The labor divide that I'm focusing on is the one that exists between our students, between those with wealth and those without. This isn't the labor divide that I, a lecturer, was probably invited to address. But lecturers like me teach mostly freshmen in small seminars, and so come to know our students and their lives outside our classrooms well. Because of our professional status, you could even say that lecturers might be more sensitive to economic precarity. But like everyone else at BU, we're part of a system that reinforces the divide between students of different class backgrounds. BU enrolls increasing numbers of economically disadvantaged students. 17.4% of last year's freshmen meet low-income criteria, up from 13.3% in fall 2015. And the university is committed to growing that number. They recently joined the American Talent Initiative, a higher ed coalition working to increase access for lower income students. And starting next year, the university will meet 100% of an admitted domestic student's calculated need. Like many of you, I applaud these efforts, but what we often overlook is what it's like for low income students once they're here at BU. In the new book, The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students, Anthony Abraham Jack cautions us about generalizations. Instead, he distinguishes between two groups of low-income students: those who attended prep schools on scholarship, the privileged poor, and those who attended underfunded public schools, the doubly disadvantaged. In their prep schools, the privileged poor are acculturated into the hidden curriculum of higher ed. how to phrase an email to an instructor, how to engage with authority figures, how to advocate for themselves, and so on. But the doubly disadvantaged haven't had access to this cultural capital. While many universities offer summer bridge programs that help low-income students transition to college life, BU doesn't yet. And regardless, professors bear responsibility. When drafting our syllabi and lesson plans, we shouldn't assume prior knowledge or experience of college norms. We shouldn't make assumptions, for example, about why students aren't attending office hours. Maybe they just need information about what office hours are. And we shouldn't assume whom such information would benefit. Being low income is an invisible and often stigmatized identity. We're all aware of this theoretically, but we need to be reminded of it, myself included. Still, the privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged share material circumstances that aren't left behind once they arrive on campus. As Jack writes, elite institutions bend over backwards to admit disadvantaged students into their hallowed halls. But then, once the students are there, they maintain policies that not only remind those students of their disadvantage, but even serve to highlight it. Over the years, some of my students have helped me to understand the effects of such policies, including my own. And I've become even more sensitive to them since I became a mentor to the university's first group of Hayden Scholars. These students are high achievers from the Bronx, all doubly disadvantaged, and they receive full tuition and room and board from the Charles Hayden Foundation. Their experiences have been mostly positive, but I'll share with you just one example of the difficulties they face. Delise, who is sitting right there, one of my mentees, is now a sophomore. She entered BU as a pre-med student and enrolled in Chemistry 101, along with 800 other aspiring doctors and researchers. She wasn't the only student to fail the first two exams. But the reasons for these failing grades and the repercussions are unique to a student like Delise. The class curriculum, she felt, assumes that students have already taken AP Chem, which wasn't offered at her high school. Group office hours were available, but Delise was working two jobs to cover the expenses that her Hayden scholarship didn't. Even after failing the second exam, she was hesitant to drop the class despite receiving a departmental email that encouraged her to. Without a W, they promised, even though the drop deadline had passed. One reason? She had spent nearly $300 on the class's requisite supplies. $300 was about one-third of what she made ringing up groceries over the summer, and she wouldn't get most of it back. The experience cast a shadow over all of her academics that semester. More significantly, it affected her sense of herself as a college student. As she recently told me, I know my chem TA was wondering, why is this girl still here? Two of the six Hayden scholars took Chemistry 101 last fall, and both ended up having to drop a class that's a gateway to STEM majors and professions. Why is this girl still here? Instead, we should ask, what message are we sending a student whose admission promises that she belongs here, but an introductory course tells her that she doesn't? What assumptions are we making when we design our own humanities curricula and courses? And what policies impose extra labor on low-income students? Do we assign expensive books? Are we sure that they already know what it means to analyze a text? Are we showing them how the course material connects to their particular lives and futures? These questions are crucial for every teacher at BU, particularly if we want to help students pursue the fields that match their intellectual interests and to ensure that the humanities don't privilege the already privileged. Thank you for listening.
I'd like to thank all of the panelists for your deeply thoughtful contributions, and I'd like to add some thoughts of my own. In the course of the day, I feel that we have been seeing and not seeing the university. And by that, I mean that we are developing a new sensibility or deepening one that we already had, a sensibility that involves holding in view many different kinds of activity and conviction simultaneously. As we have said in a variety of ways today, the university is an invaluable space of questioning, dialogue, argument, discovery, and comment. I think it is important as we set out on the discussion for this panel on labor divides to see and acknowledge that multiplicity of speech and inquiry. But as our panelists suggest, and as others have suggested today, notably on the preceding panel, it is also useful and necessary to not see the open-minded and open-ended inquiry so as to perceive to make sensible to ourselves and to hold in view other processes that happen in and around speech and thought, out of which speech and thought are partly constituted. Susan Mizrukhi asked at the beginning, what can be said and who can say it? And I think we've had some responses to that question here. The participants on this panel have drawn our attention to different positionalities and perspectives, to lacks of recognition and misreadings of the location of knowledge and expertise, to imbalances of power affecting those called upon to speak, to economic inequalities that shape capacities to succeed, and to fears of retaliation for speaking. And on that note, I want to thank the panelists in this and other panels for their courage in speaking in this format. Our panelists have also offered suggestions for how to combat these differences, misrecognitions, imbalances, and fears, among them occupying a range of positions, claiming knowledge and requesting recognition, recognizing the consequences of economic precariousness on multiple levels at the university, offering extra credit points to those who voice corrections or challenges as a signal from those with greater power that speaking in their presence can be safe. And finally, sitting down, solidarity involving people and their labor, as Kimber mentioned on the last panel, and finally, sitting down at a bargaining table. I'd like to invite participants on the panel to comment on each other's shop talk, and I'd like to start us off by posing some brief questions to the panelists that you should feel free to respond to or ignore. As you see fit, I'll just throw them out and then we can see, and I'm also going to, as soon as I open this, bring in some of the questions that have already been sent in as part of what I'm posing. For Charles, I wonder if you could comment up a bit and say something about how the story or parable you've offered us about offering extra credit points might translate into levels of power where it's not extra credit points that are handed out, but what other kinds of... I'm going to throw all these questions out. Nancy, a question came in from the audience. My question is for Nancy. How can we all be as self-actualized and excellent as you? And I wanted to turn that into a question by posing to you and all of us, what are some of the difficulties of being self-actualized and excellent in a workplace such as this? And I'm sure many of us might have comments on that. For Daniel, one of the questions that came in is what mechanisms can be enacted to educate all parties about the multiple priorities within the institution to lessen gulfs of understanding? And I wanted to add to that and push you a little. I believe you implied, although you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the further one goes, quote unquote, up from department to high administration, the more one sees. But I think panelists today have actually suggested it might be the less one sees. So I wonder how that two sets of possibilities can be held together. For Jessica, you've, I think, in a day of talking about communication and appreciative listening, you've brought us to the notion of the bargaining table. And I would welcome you or other people saying more about that. Where might a bargaining table be? What are its uses? Are there limits to a bargaining table? What are the rules of the bargaining table? So what does that bargaining table mean to you is really what I'm asking. And for... Marisa, by focusing on your students, you've really brought us to the question of what the purpose of this university is and for whom, and in a very micro level, what are we doing in the classroom? And I wonder if you have any thoughts more broadly about the university that come to you from starting on that level. So again, I don't want to put people on the spot with a particular question. If anyone would like to respond, or we can just open it to the audience. Any takers on the panel?
Sure. So how do you give, like, extra credit to a faculty member, let's say? I think that the spirit of the policy that I described is one of kind of recognition of the difficulty of speaking. And, you know, that basic principle you know, you can imagine being sort of part of a merit evaluation, for example. So, like when different faculty members get merit reviews from you know, I guess the senior faculty in their department, I've actually never heard anyone be explicitly praised for addressing like a difficult topic or you know, offering criticism. Whereas I have heard many cases of people being kind of chastised for their strong opinions. And so like when you see this contrast, it's not hard to understand why people who are kind of in a position to be evaluated by people at a higher level would be reluctant or think twice about ever saying anything that's difficult. So yeah, I guess that's kind of the spirit in which that policy is trying to offer itself.
Thank you. I don't mind jumping in. I am really interested to hear your answer to this question. I interpreted it as a literal bargaining table, and as somebody who has come out of that process of being at a bargaining table with the administration, I can tell you it's there are some things you'd rather not see. But I'm going to take on. I'm going to instead. I'm taking on this really lofty topic, you know, what is the purpose of the university? And I think I'm going to instead bring it back to my classroom, because I actually teach a course called BU and the Culture of College. Mm-hmm. And in that course, students design research projects around the interests, their own interests related to their undergraduate experience. So anything from what it's like to be Black at BU to what it's like to not have international food available to you in the dorms. You know, what are the driving issues of interest? We also debate, you know, based upon the fundamental, not values, but founding principles of higher ed. We debate, you know, is it really this ideal just development of habits of mind? Or is it something more, and I'm not using this pejoratively, instrumental, job training? And students, and I think they're right to, see those not at odds. They see them as deeply interconnected. And I think it is up to us to help students recognize that it is not demeaning the value of university to think about it in terms of its professional training. I think especially when they're being asked to pay as much as they are and are not confident that they will be able to work their way out of that debt, I think it's important for us to bring those two lines of inquiry that help shape higher education together.
Any other takers on the panel?
Nancy?
Daniel?
Well, I'm happy to respond, Jeff, to what you said. I mean, so first of all, I realized I was saying, I think, two different things. I think one I would stick with, and the other I would back down from a bit in response to your question. So on the one hand, I would stick to the point that I think that universities and scholarly production is organized according to disciplines, and that has some serious constraining, limiting facts on the way, and I'll just say we, since I spent most of my life as a faculty member, see as faculty members and what we defend. But I take your point about seeing less. So I think my point was that in an administrative position, success partially means trying to see the university holistically. Are there things that we don't see? I would say that, and of course I can't speak for all administrators, I think as an administrator one sees in a particular way. And, you know, so when I was at Wisconsin, I think one of the ways that I saw was shaped a great deal by pressure from the state legislature and our need to respond to that. And so I think faculty rightly were critical of some of the determinations and decisions administrators made. But I also think that at least I believe that the administrators were constrained by their structural location to respond in a particular way to the legislature. So here I am at BU. I think the constraints that in my role I face are things that I didn't probably expect. Budget is a big one. And things like rankings, which are things that I've written critically about, and now I am acting, I wouldn't say to defend, but in response to. So I guess I would say, you know, without wanting to engage in too much justification for what it is that I do, that I think, like, so Karl Marx used the term Traeger to refer to the idea that we are bearers of social positions, we are subject to the constraints of our social locations, and I would say that administrators are that. And I think it's good that administrators are pushed by faculty and students, because I think for many administrators, broadly speaking, we have differences, but the underlying values that we are pushed against are probably values that under other conditions we would vocally support.
Could I push you in response to a question here? This is not me, this is a question that came in for Daniel. How does Jessica's analysis of power and notion of the bargaining table apply to your experience handling labor issues as graduate provost?
So, I mean, I would be lying if I said that the issue of unionization weren't an issue for graduate students and hasn't come before my desk. It's interesting, I feel like I can't say too much about this, but I will say that as a graduate student, I was a member of a union. I started my political life at 13 years old, walking the picket line for the United Farm Workers Union. I'm in a different structural location now, but I also think that Jessica talked a lot about her treatment as a worker, and I think we do a disservice to our students when we treat them as workers, which is to say that we bring in PhD students, we should be here to give them an education. When a faculty member with a large laboratory says, I need more graduate students because I need more hands in the lab, we should say, I'm sorry, but if you want more hands in the lab, you should hire a technician or somebody else. If you're interested in training somebody for a wide array of careers, treating them to reasonable hours with reasonable benefits, then we're happy to have you do that. I think similarly with regard to teaching fellows, if a class gets larger, we shouldn't say, gosh, we need to have more graduate students. We should say, how many graduate students can we reasonably train, and what kind of experience can we give those graduate students? And then if we still need, to use the term, I think fairly, that Jessica used, labor support, we should be hiring professional teaching assistants.
Jessica, I hope I can invite you to talk about the bargaining table. I'm going to throw a question at you also that just came in. Charles's students wouldn't correct him, though he'd have welcomed it. Would Jessica see here a hope that her profs may reward disclosure, not retaliate? And I hear the bargaining table as a suggestion that, no, that's actually not a hope you feel is warranted at this moment. But I open that to you.
Okay. I'll start with the bargaining table and then move to talking about retaliation, I think, in there. So I think about the bargaining table as both, I think, something literal and then something as an ideal, that a bargaining table is a chance for workers to be recognized as equals by their bosses, administrators who are people in a position, in a job. And for us, I think, like Charles said, it's a moment for people in more powerful positions, bosses in this instance, to demonstrate clearly with a concrete action that is coming to a table, literally, metaphorically, that some sort of honesty is valued. And in this case, honesty, that working conditions are not up to par, that pay is whatever, or, you know, with a list of demands. And that by ceding some ground, ceding power, ceding money, ceding these very material realities, that there will not be retaliation, and that at a bargaining table, there is a formal structure in place that guarantees these things. And that without that structure, I think it's difficult for many people in my position or in positions where they have limited power to imagine disclosing all sorts of things to their bosses when they are in fear that that disclosure could affect their position, what type of work they're assigned, how many hours they're assigned, their future at the organization. And I think with regards to retaliation, I think, you know, I have the same hopes that professors regard disclosures, whether they're in the classroom or in a private office, with, I think, compassion and a desire to do the right thing. And I think beyond that, there are multiple things at play. I think we often get caught up in the trope of a lone bad actor without also recognizing that there are systemic forces here that and a culture of that discourages people from reporting, and that when people do report and when people do disclose, it's pushed aside and it's downplayed, whether in the moment or later, and that retaliation doesn't always look like what you think it looks like. And you can't retaliate if you don't think there was something to disclose in the first place, if you don't believe the disclosure was worth disclosing.
I'd like to focus a little bit on retaliation. So I have something to say, and I also wanted to invite people here. I've been taking questions from here, but if people would like to come to the mics. One of the earlier commenters, and I don't know the person's name, I'm sorry, said that being heard is a form of work that often leads to more work. And she said that she sometimes feels too busy to do the work of being heard, and I would like to add that I think sometimes it's too risky to do the work of being heard. And as a white male older professor with tenure, I think it is useful and important here to say that I have felt BU at times to be a culture of have a culture of retaliation. Jonathan Zatlin said earlier that there is a culture of bullying and intimidation here. Now, I don't want that to be the final word. I have experienced many extremely positive things about Boston University, but I can only imagine how hard it is to speak and fear retaliation from a position not as secure as my own, and I just wanted to put that on the table.
Thanks. Thank you all. I just, as you said, courage, Jeffrey, and that is a word that's ringing in my head, too. My question comes partially from the previous panel on the corporate university. And it's interesting to me that here in the middle of the day, I'm thinking labor also indicates a kind of corporate structure of the university, and especially with Marisa's ending on students and the divide between students and class. I'm wondering if you would comment on this question that of the student as consumer, which in some ways, I think you mentioned, Marisa, that having them think about getting a degree and going out to a professional education shouldn't be surprising given that they're paying, I don't know, $65,000 a year to be here. But at the same time, what we're sort of thinking about in terms of our labor, their labor, protecting them? Does it seem correct to think of them as consumers supporting their tuition with their tuition dollars, our labor as university workers? It could be for anyone, and not just for Marisa.
You guys want to comment?
It's a tricky question, and we sort of touched upon it in the last panel, in terms of like the commodification of higher ed. Maybe I'll offer a little bit of a different spin on it, because this was an idea we talked about in that class, BU and the Culture of College, a lot. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting to them was just the need for transparency and a basic understanding of the system in which they operate. My students did not understand the structure of the university. They don't understand different ranks, what that means. They didn't understand what teaching evaluations mean to somebody like me. You know, that's job security. And they don't understand even where their dollars are going. I had a student do a research project about the anxiety around the bill, the tuition bill that she would receive every semester, because there was no itemization of that bill. Like, I just need to know where this money is going. Just the basic information. So I think that's what I want to comment on, is the lack of education that our students have about this system in which they are consumers in many ways and are thought of as consumers. They don't really know what they're buying.
I would just add to that despite being about retaliation, I am deeply invested in what is most valuable about this university. And when I hear the question about consumers, I also deeply take it as my job as an advisor to students, which is something I think I have something to contribute to students, to open their eyes to the many things in addition to and around. So I'm in no way disagreeing with you, but we can hold both of those open together. I think just as in terms of Daniel, where the clarity of perception or breadth of view is, it might be in multiple places. I heard Kimber earlier talking mm-hmm. about solidarity among people in different labor positions and about reciprocity. I think that one of the things we might be hearing here is a call for holding this multiplicity in view and really digging in and perhaps for a more daring and bold view of what we are doing here than we're used to articulating.
No?
Yes. Yes.
I'd like to pick up on something Jessica said about the fantasy of a bad actor and how that doesn't necessarily sort with the structural or fear caused by structural conditions. I think walking into a situation like this, the fear is there structurally, whether or not you believe people are, you know, evil or have bad intent. And, the other part of what I want to get to with that is I've been noticing a lot of metaphors of, there's extra credit and there's poverty and there's cultural capital and there's value, legitimating or, you know, defending the value of a liberal arts education, which could mean the spiritual value, but I have a feeling it has to do something with that $65,000. And I'm going to mangle Marx here, but in a capitalist system, there is a tendency to treat relationships between people as relationships between commodities. I, for my part, have long since I've been here had a fantasy of on the first day of class saying, "You all get A's. Now let's learn something." But I haven't done this partly for fear that I would debase the currency, and that's doing my students a disservice. They don't want me to do that. I don't think. I mean, I've asked them, some of them said that sounds like a great idea, but I don't think so. Because if all of my students get A's, then what is an A worth? And an A is worth something outside of my classroom, whether or not I make it worth something inside my classroom. So my point is that all of us are working within a larger set of structures over which we have very little control. We do have some control, I hope, of how we respond to those pressures and those structures. But this whole discussion is happening within a set of financially determined forces over which we have very little control. And I'm wondering how much hope there is then, short of a revolution.
How much hope short of a revolution? Who wants to take that one on?
I'll give it a shot.
Okay, thank you.
So I think that you're right in that there is often a tendency to focus on these kind of individual responsibilities or, I guess, failures that we have to one another. And within the university, I think a corporate university, within any business, I think one of the things that's really important or that we fail to see sometimes is that these people they're not just people. It's not just it's not a social position. We're individuals doing jobs, and we are constrained by the forces of the institution. But of course, you always have room to make things better for your students, for your coworkers, for your colleagues, in the same way that any one professor can make my working conditions or my life in my department significantly better on a day-to-day. They do not have any say over whether my pay goes up or down. But there are individuals in the university that do make those decisions. Those decisions are made by real people, and those people are some of your bosses. They're not my boss unless we go up and up and up, but they're somebody's boss, and somebody does have the power to talk to them and to hop across this divide, metaphorical, real, whatever it is. And someone's not doing that, or it's failing, and it's these other constraints around, for me, it's the fear of speaking out about what these real working conditions are. For some of our students, it's the fear that the professor will look at them and say, why did you tell me that I made a mistake? And they're embarrassed, and their grade starts to drop, or they start retaliating in class. And it's all these different layers, and it's based on power. And we know these things exist, and yet we continue to not apply them to the very real individuals around us. And I think we're all smarter than that.
I'm just going to add a couple of words. I wouldn't want to deny for a minute that this is a structure built on relationships of power, and or that it exists within a larger capitalist economy. I think, however, we make an important strategic mistake if we start calling a university a business, because when we start doing that, we start treating it more like a business. And if universities are no different than businesses, then I would be just as happy to work somewhere else. And I would say the same with students as consumers. Yes, in many ways, we are inevitably forced to treat students like consumers. I don't think we should call them consumers, and I think we should make a powerful effort not to treat them as consumers. And I would finally say that, you know, I would be disingenuous to say that you know, our graduate students who serve as teaching fellows and research assistants are not sometimes treated as workers. But I think that we are doing a disservice to them and to the mission of the university if we don't work to treat them as students.
Hi, my name... Can you hear me now?
Yes.
My name is Brother Larry Whitney. I'm a university chaplain at Marsh Chapel, and full disclosure, a member of the Free Speech Operations Committee, and have been listening intently about implications for some of our free speech work across the day. I want to ask a slightly different question here, though. We live in a society, a culture, a politics, a democratic politics that values equality. But we heard Provost Morrison on the previous panel identify that the next version of the strategic plan will center diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so, and equality and equity are very different things. And so I'm interested to hear what you would imagine that the positions that you represent, because I take Charles and Marissa to be representing a student position, even though you're yourselves faculty and this panel, you've been representing a student position, what the positions you represent on the panel would need to achieve equity within the ecology of higher education broadly, but particularly here at Boston University.
What you said actually just reminded me that I had something to say in regard to the last question, but so I actually have imagined, like in regard to what I had described before, whether like in a different world in which maybe I didn't assign grades or everyone got an A, whether students' reluctance to challenge authority would still exist. And I think the answer to that is yes, because the power differential actually, you know, maybe it's partly related to the evaluative role, but that evaluative role is not like limited to the classroom. I mean, someone who's a professor, that's someone that a student will ask a recommendation from later, and so on and so forth. So I think the issue or challenge for achieving equity is more complex than I think I actually have an answer to. But I would actually defer to Jessica. Maybe she has better ideas. Because it's larger. The power differential, I think, is much larger than any individual pair of student and teacher, for example.
Do you want to take that, Jessica? Or I have some thoughts.
I think we'd like to hear from you, but the only thing I would say is, so you're asking me, you know, from the position that I'm representing here, and that's from a student's position, but I wouldn't want to assume that I know the student's position. So I think let's ask them.
I would add to that that I think there are two kinds of answers to that question that are coming up from this panel. When I teach a seminar, it's my commitment and job, and I hope my skill, to create a space for speech and to, in some way, with all due realization of the things I don't know and the complexities of it, to cut through some of those differences to enable a discussion and to communicate to students that they can create that discussion and that we learn from each other. That does not exclude needing to be available in my office hours to hear about particular students. And I would also add, I teach about the border, I teach about protest and resistance in the Americas. One of the characteristics of BU now more than in the past is that whatever we're talking about in class that happens outside in the world is also happening in the classroom, in the lives of the students. So that they're creating a space of voice and equity is a possibility in that regard. But there's also the bargaining table, and I want to keep coming back to that. And people have talked about identities as a worker or a consumer. I'm starting to think, what is not worker? Is there an identity of not worker that we as workers would also want to have? And what assurances at the bargaining table or elsewhere need to be offered to people as workers so that they can engage other aspects of themselves that might not be consumers and workers? So I just think we've got a lot in play here.
I'd also like to add, I think on the issue of equity and equality, I'm coming back to some thoughts that I've been thinking maybe since Kimber's remarks earlier. Who gets to have access to education, to higher education even? And when we think about equity and equality and the rising cost of higher education with master's and professional programs and even PhD programs, thinking about yes, programs are fully funded at BU for doctoral students, but not 12 months a year. And we exist as humans 12 months a year, and we pay bills 12 months a year. But when we then think about the background of students who are coming into programs, who isn't able to come into the programs, who isn't able to stay in the programs, who's thinking about starting a family, who has to drop out because of medical issues, because the health insurance doesn't cut it, because of dental care and ongoing surgeries, because it's just unsustainable. And I think there's a lot more to keep digging with regards to equity.
I first want to thank all of you. I was very inspired by some of your talks. And my question
kind of...
Can you
just repeat your name?
Oh, Kimber. I'm Kimber. Hi. I wanted to kind of ask a question that follows Professor Rubin's comment about the not worker and a little bit of Daniel Kleiman's comment about whether or not this is a business or not and the kind of uneasiness that we feel with the word corporate or business and applied to universities, because it's both, right? It's hard because we don't want it to be a business and there are business aspects that nobody can deny, but it also, we want it to be something else and we believe in education as something else, as perhaps a right even. But my question is, if the way that it's structured right now, even the kind of uneasiness or confusion kind of limits our imaginations about what could be, this is kind of in terms of work or not work and, you know, whether hearings work. We're asking a lot of actually very big philosophical questions about labor and what that means. But I think, you know, is it the way that it's structured? And I'm glad that it's coming from a place of labor that I'm asking this, but does it limit our imaginations about what we exist as and what we could be? You know, I think a lot of times we think about solutions now in universities as very technocratic, as solving like one particular problem. And I'm just wondering if there could be more, or if we could like try to manifest ways in which there could be more that we're using with our educations and with what we assume universities to be. When I was doing research for critical university studies, I saw a quote that I'll never forget that's, you know, academics often mistake the most interesting questions with the right questions, and I'm not sure that they're always the same thing, and I was like, wow, I need to really think about that. So I'm just wondering if we have any thoughts about its structuring and kind of the poverty of imagination that we might feel.
And I also want to open that question up to the audience in further questions and comments, as well as to the panel.
Well, my question does kind of actually build on this a little bit about imagining the possibilities. Because I think really when we're talking about the bargaining table, as far as grad workers are concerned, we're imagining different possibilities, or at least we're trying to do that. But I have a couple of different points. My specific question is for Marisa. I would love to know what happens at the bargaining table. And I really mean that in like a very serious way, because this is in reference to the word transparency has been tossed around a few times, and this is something I heard on WBUR, so I'm super excited to say this here. I'm a huge WBUR fan, by the way. But it was a conversation about how transparency is, the word transparency is often used when we feel distrust, we feel a lack of trust. Transparency is often used as a substitute for trust. We ask for transparency when we say we don't, when we're trying to say otherwise that we don't trust the system that we're working in. So I ask very specifically, what happens at the bargaining table? Because we have not been given a bargaining table to experience. And there is quite a bit that resonates with me about what Jessica was saying about not feeling especially comfortable. I'm very nervous now. I'm sure you can hear my voice is shaking about saying that, baked into your statement, Provost Kleiman, that we are students. There are obligations built into the student relationship that are not always respected or met on behalf of advisors or administrators for the graduate workers that we have to report to them. I was explicitly told by an advisor that he did not have time to advise me in the way that I needed to be advised. So imagine how I feel as a student hearing that. My teacher, whose job it is to teach me, doesn't have time to do that. So I get passed along to a variety of other advisors, to the point where now I don't have an advisor at Boston University. And that's a very precarious position to be in, to not have an advisor at your institution, where I'm also told that my relationship to this institution is specifically educational. At this moment, it feels explicitly economic. I work here. I teach in the writing program. I work in a Carroll in the library, and I do have an office space that's been given to me, but I don't feel comfortable standing here right now saying to you that I feel as though my relationship to this institution is purely economic, because the fellowship award that awaits my return once my time with the writing program is over could be taken away at any moment. So I really don't think that we can undervalue the importance of a contract and the ability to rebuild this trust. So I understand that things happen at a bargaining table that I haven't sat at, that I don't understand, and I would love some transparency about that so that I can be entrusted to embark on that conversation and have a say in what happens at this institution to my fellow workers and myself. And I would also conclude by saying, I know I have to wrap up, that if we talk about equity in higher education, if we want to know why graduate programs are so white and so wealthy, I'm a privileged poor person at this moment. I can afford to be a graduate student because I come from an upper middle class family that paid my way through college. I don't have student loan debt. That's why I can afford to live on $20,000 a year plus occasional funding in the summer and credit cards. So what happens at the bargaining table? What can we learn that we can have these conversations in a very real way?
Okay, so can I? Okay. Christina, are you here? Christina Michaud? Oh, no. Okay, because she's at one of our union reps. But I think when I made the comment about the bargaining table, like, it can be a dark place. Yeah. I was not able to sit at the bargaining table because while we were under negotiations with the university, I was in an administrative role. So I was considered corporate, I guess. I was management, thank you. I wasn't sure which boss. I got myself there a couple of times under the guise of ignorance. Like, I should be here, right? Because I would eventually return to the role of lecturer, which I am. I'm no longer management. And then they kicked me out. So, but what I would say is, if you, I won't go into specifics about what happens there. We have a union steward in the writing program who's excellent, and he knows. I can give you, after this, we can meet and I'll give you the information. But what I can tell you is it makes transparent what the university feels about you. You've long suspected it. But to have it articulated in blunt language is very hurtful. So I think we managed to secure more money for ourselves. But as you know, lecturers are significantly underpaid. And there was a great emotional cost, because lecturers left those negotiations having won, but having lost a lot emotionally.
I'd just like to underscore that the emotional toll of the issues that we're talking about is a really important thing to put out on the table. Oh, thank you. Go right ahead.
Hi. So my question, I actually have a...
Re-identify yourself.
Yes. I'm Nazli Kibria, Professor of Sociology, Associate Dean, CIS, Social Sciences. So my question, I'd actually have a genuine question I've been, you know, sort of wondering about. So I would like some more explanation about this division of between being a student and a worker for graduate students, or if the line is as clear as kind of I'm hearing. I was a graduate student, and I've also worked with graduate students, and I understand that graduate students contribute their labor as teaching fellows and teaching assistants. I completely understand that, But I don't think my understanding was always that those activities were, not purely, but they were sort of meant to have an educational component, that it's good for your resume when you leave graduate school to have been a teaching fellow. You learn how to teach, you have these experiences when you teach alone. And when I think, back to advising graduate students, or even when I advise graduate students now, I'm trying to kind of figure out myself. I don't see them as employees, and I mean that seems kind of not at all right to me. It doesn't feel right. That's not what the relationship is about. And I'm very sympathetic to the exploitation, graduate students, and the kind of poor pay, working conditions, all of that. But I'm just struggling as a faculty member who I've always taken the mentoring and care of my graduate students very, very seriously. I'm just wondering why I can't identify with that.
I'll just comment really quickly. So I know that the structure of some funding for PhD students at least involves kind of regular teaching fellowships or research fellowships. So the research fellowships, I know in some departments are substantive, and in fact, like you're supposed to be basically working on a project that's going to at least could lead to publication. But then I've also heard of research fellowships that where the student's not doing anything that could be construed as kind of leading to that kind of outcome, like making photocopies or whatever. And so, I mean, I guess the short answer is, I think the idea or the ideal is that this is a training-oriented experience, but that there are these individual differences that at least I've heard about that make it such that, yeah, I could understand certainly why it would be perceived as basically work, depending on what you're doing.
What about holding both simultaneously? It seems to me that it takes attending to the economic needs of graduate students in a serious, rule-bound, bargaining table way to enable the other kind of relationship. If there's a non-worker relationship or another aspect of a worker relationship, it seems to me that one of the things we're talking about is how to attend to both those. And I would just add, and then turn it over to others, that there's no bargaining table for graduate students. There's a bargaining table that brings some gains and a lot of emotional pain for lecturers. We haven't heard from adjuncts, and there is no bargaining table for tenured and tenure track faculty. There are, in fact, major gender pay disputes going on at BU right now that don't have a bargaining table, have only sort of unspecified lines of communication up and down the hierarchy. So this is, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't want to take attention away from the graduate student situation, but I want to see it as not unique and off to one side, but also characteristic of multiple other positions here.
Yeah. First, and I'll go after.
It's fine. And to be clear, I can only speak to the experience as a graduate student and worker. And I think holding the tension of both roles is precisely what we're asked to do. The money that we are paid is sometimes characterized as compensation for our research and for focusing on our research and coursework, and sometimes characterized as compensation for our teaching load. And then in the rest of our spare time, we're expected to continue making progress on our research, on our dissertation, on any other courses we may be teaching. That varies incredibly wildly from department to department, discipline to discipline, and yet the pay is, to the best of my knowledge, generally consistent across departments, with variation being in the number of months that graduate student workers are paid throughout the year. And so one of my first questions is, so if we're only on a research-based stipend, it's generally considered that when we're teaching, it's for around, we're being compensated for an average of 20 hours per week. We are compensated the exact same amount for the research-based stipend. Are we expected then to only work 20 hours per week on our dissertation and do nothing for the rest of the other time? Or is that compensation then tied to something else entirely? I think that's a question worth perhaps investigating. Secondly, when we look at the actual work of teaching and the relationships that we have to the professors we teach with or for, because I have never taught a class by myself at Boston University. I used to be a lecturer at Emory University. But here at Boston University, I have taught as a teaching fellow, and so never alone, but only leading sections and discussions. The professors I teach with do determine the work that I do, much as a boss does. They do not have say in how much I am paid or the exact number of the actual limit, the cap on the hours that I work, much as like a upper level management might, but they do have a say in whether I'm going over that or not, and I'm not being compensated when I do. They do have a say in whether or not I'm making photocopies and uploading dozens and dozens of PDFs to Blackboard as the only work I'm doing that week, or whether my work is substantively focused on grading and working directly with students and trying to learn how to, I think, engage more directly in what will happen hopefully for my future teaching training. And I think that varies widely from what I know of folks across disciplines and across departments, and depending on the courses that folks are assigned to. Sometimes you're assigned to teach, to be a teaching fellow in a class that has 30 students, and you grade, and that's it. And sometimes you're leading 3-4 discussion sections, or holding office hours for 120 students with a line of 15 to 20 outside your door for hours on end. And they all come in crying with emotional problems because they're failing every exam. And they don't know what to do, and they don't know where to go. And it starts here, and it continues for the entire semester. And so you're doing all types of different labor that we are also not trained to do. And you quickly adapt and you adjust, but some folks have better support than others in their departments and in their mentors and in the folks that they're working with. And I think just as we are struggling with being students and working, the professors we're working with are struggling with being bosses and mentors at the same time.
And employees.
Yep.
Which
I was just going to add a couple things quickly. The first is that I think all graduate assistantships should be primarily substantive. If they're not, we shouldn't be offering them at all. The second thing I would say is that it, as a general rule, one of the speakers got up and said that the professor said he didn't have time, or she didn't have time, or they didn't have time to mentor her. And as a general matter, I think that's not an acceptable answer. Not knowing the specifics, obviously, I can't say a lot more. And then just going back to this idea of the limits of our imagination from a few minutes ago about what the university is, I think it's really important to think about different kinds of universities. So this is neither a public university with state subsidy, nor an affluent private university with a huge endowment. And I think those things, you know, we were talking about systemic and structural constraints earlier today, and just being realistic, that makes a difference in what kind of university we have and what kind of flexibilities we have or don't have.
So we have a bit more time, so how about both questions, and then if you could keep them relatively short, and then we'll have some time to answer it. Okay, so maybe 3 questions relatively quickly, and then we'll respond as we can. Identify yourself, please.
Takeo Rivera, assistant professor in English. So I'm not quite sure what's so difficult to understand about the notion of graduate students being workers, frankly. I mean, Jessica, you just provided this extremely eloquent defense, which I think was not even necessary, because it's clear that without graduate student workers, without adjuncts, there would be no curriculum at all, right? Like, we require this labor. It's as simple as that. And this notion that if you are a student, you can't be a worker. Well, faculty, we're students too. We're learning, we're always doing research as well. So that boundary really is much blurrier than we'd like to think. So, you know, so I just want to just totally validate what you're saying, Jessica. So with that in mind, and with the sort of curious way in which tenure stream faculty or people who are trying to get tenure, such as myself, are sort of positioned, right? We're positioned as this kind of, intermediary force in between those who identify as workers and those who are kind of aspiring to be, you know, the university bourgeoisie, as it were. So I guess the question is, what can we do as tenure track and tenured faculty to be in solidarity with graduate students, with the adjuncts who are not being represented on this panel, and with non-tenure stream faculty, and also with staff, and also with janitorial workers? What can we do from our position of relative privilege to support these efforts?
I have a question that sort of...
identify yourself.
I'm Carrie Babitsky. I'm a PhD candidate as well. I have a question about this notion, this sort of fuzzy notion of training, and the fact that training as a graduate student is somehow outside of our role as workers, because we are certainly trained to teach in the classroom. We're trained to research. We're trained to write. But we're not offered in any sort of substantive, to use the term, way, the sort of financial allocations that make those things possible, right? We exchange our labor in the classroom, we certainly do. We exchange our labor wildly outside of the classroom as well in various sorts of ways, helping out to make sure that the classroom is even set up for class for our professor when we walk in. And then we're expected to go out and do our research without some sort of research track line of funding that helps support us. So our stipends are not substantive. And if they are not substantive, then, you know, why do we keep having this conversation about whether or not they should even be offered?
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. My name is Trish Ward from Department of Sociology. I wanted to ask, we've said labor a lot, but what do we mean by labor? When you were coming to that term, what is in your mind when you say it, and how you're articulating what labor is? How do you see that as, in light of this title, how do you see that as opening a door for more dialogue with other labor movements? But do you think in some ways it might be shutting people off too, that otherwise would be on the agenda for, you know, we're all workers in some ways, right? Worker and non-worker. How do we talk about labor, and how does that alienate people, but also how does that provide a way to build bridges? So if you could talk about that a little bit more.
Thank you. We've got three questions on the table. Not very much time, but short responses would be more than welcome.
Well, I guess I'll jump in to kind of address Takeo's question. I mean, from the point of view of faculty, I mean, I think one thing you could do is offer like substantive work to do. I mean, the philosophy that faculty in linguistics at least have recently talked about is that something that is done under the rubric of a research fellowship should actually be not an assignment, but a collaboration or conversation that happens with the student, so that, you know, through that collaboration, you develop something that the student is going to get something out of because they had input into exactly what that project or that piece of work was going to be. So yeah, I mean, I guess that stands in contrast to just things that I've heard about some other research fellowships that haven't been substantive in that way. And I gather that it's easier for things to work out that way if it's kind of a more one-sided or top-down development.
Any other comments? Nancy?
I'll jump in. The question about labor. From an administrative point of view, labor, I think if we're comfortable, if there's a comfortability with conversation from the workers, me being the worker, with my boss, I think that there's a lot that can be accomplished. And I think if there's dual respect for the conversation at hand, and people are willing to listen, and I think that has a lot to do with this labor divides issue, and respecting the person that's offering the information, I think will go a long way. And I think that treating people the way you want to be treated is a good place to start. And I think that if we all treat each other with the same respect that we want to have, we'll go a long way.
And a good place to end. Okay. Thank you.